Thank you. Okay, dear brethren, Brother Rick is going to share his lesson today. Again, harmonizing the events surrounding our Lord's resurrection. Harmonizing the events. Here we go.
Thank you. Thank you, brother. And thank you, Brother Jeff, for your prayer. Brother, I gave you two handouts, and the one, of course, is multiple copies. I'm really this is two lessons that I'm short shifting the first one, which is really a lesson we have on the history of the Garden, Tomb, Golgotha, and Mount Moriah, which is a historical, biblical history of that area. And I'm going to introduce that a little bit to help understand some of the aspects of the really more important lesson of the harmonizing the sequence of events as recorded in the four Gospels about what happened on the resurrection morning. Because the four Gospels each give us different information and sometimes seemingly contradictory. So it takes a little bit of effort. And what we're going to offer, of course, it's in the way of suggestion. There might be a better way to harmonize it. But this is an offering. And it does work with covering each of the scriptures. No one of the four gospel accounts will fully explain everything that happened that morning. So it takes the four of them, but no particular one of them gives you everything in sequence either. So we do a little back and forth. It's a, you know, today's term we'd say a little cutting and pasting, point and click. But actually, that's not unusual. You remember reading the reprint where Brother Russell brings out about the what some people, critics of the Bible, portray as a disharmony of the Gospels. He used the Battle of Waterloo, and remember he quoted historical quotes on how General Wellington, he said the battle started at this time. One of the other French generals said it started at that time. Really, it was a couple hours later. He has like four different eyewitnesses. All were there, and they all gave seriously different starts for the battle. Now, you would think that'd be pretty easy, right? But it just demonstrates it's from your perspective and experience. So we have a historical record of that, of a great event like Waterloo. So it's not unusual with the gospel. In fact, when police detectives interrogate different crime scene suspects, if their stories match exactly, that creates suspicion. Because they know that the human tendency is to perceive the series of events from your perspective, and someone else is going to have a little different perspective and remembrance of it. And how often does that happen with husband and wives when we're telling our favorite story? Our spouse is correcting us. And if you know someone that's never happened, that's pretty unusual. It happens to most of us. Okay, the first part, like I said, we're going to kind of go lickety-split through it. If I was to ask you where Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice, what area would you say? Mount Moriah. Yeah, we're given that right in script. God told Abraham to go to Mount Moriah. So it was God's instruction. Now, that being said, and we know what that represents, in 1 Kings 21, I said that wrong, 1 Chronicles 21, David's sin is being punished. David left it to the Lord, the punishment. The punishment takes place, and the death angel is destroying in Jerusalem, verse 15. And then what we see is David repents, as it were, and cries out in verse 16. And then Verse 21:18. Then the angel of the Lord commanded Gad to say to David that David should go up and set up an altar under the Lord in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. And then we continue in the account and we see that's what David did. He went up to Ornan the Jebusite. And remember, the Jebusites were the ancient inhabitants of the city of Jerusalem. Jabus ends up being the first part of Jerusalem. And Salem, as we know, where Melchizedek was from, is the latter part. And when you bump the two together, the word smiths come out with Jerusalem. But the here, David purchases the sacrifice, the land, even the material to offer the animal sacrifices upon. But the Lord directed him to that location. Then in 2 Chronicles 3:1, his son Solomon, being directed to build the temple, tells us that when Solomon began to build the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, where was it? In Mount Moriah, where God had appeared to David. Abraham offered Isaac on Mount Moriah at God's direction, was willing to offer Isaac. The Lord provided the sacrifice and the ram. God directed David to sacrifice on Ornan the Jebusite's property, which turns out here, we're told, to be Mount Moriah. And that's where the temple was to be built. The offering of the willingness of the offering of Isaac there, David sacrifices there to stop the death angel, and now the temple is going to be built there with its brazen altar, with the thousands of animal sacrifices that would take place there. Now, Mount Moriah. Where's Mount Moriah? That's the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. On your handout, the last page, very poor copy, but it's out of a Biblical Archaeology Review of a number of years ago. This page here. What this is, it's a topographical map of Mount Moriah. The purpose of this was, this page, it was to demonstrate, actually, the bedrock of Mount Moriah, the Temple Mount, and what you look like, which at first appearance looked like maybe little odd buildings or structures on top. Actually, what it's showing you are subterranean chambers beneath the surface. Those are all beneath the surface. The walls you see all around are different construction walls. Now, the way Solomon and then later Zerubbabel and then even later yet with Herod the Great's enhancements, not a new temple but an enhancement of the second temple, what they did for that Temple Mount in order to build a structure and a courtyard of size to hold thousands of people, there was a certain chiseling and leveling of the surface. But they would build these walls, which are retaining walls, and they would backfill that with earth and stone and rock to build a platform which they could level off. And it's not an unusual construction feature. That's certainly done today in the building of a home. If you build on the side of a hill, your basement reflects the accommodating features of the block in order to have a level surface to build the house, even though the land slopes away on both sides, for example. That's what this is. But the one feature I'd really like you to note is right in the center, there's a little bump. It's the highest point of Mount Moriah. And today, that's what the Dome of the Rock is built around. That's the rock inside the Dome of the Rock of the Muslims. Now, in about 1882, a British officer on holiday, as they like to say, was traveling from some service assignment in India back to Britain, and he took his holiday in the Holy Land, and he was a reverential man, Protestant of some type, and he was interested, and he was doing research in the area about 1882. And one of the things we read in his writings is that this rock is about 50 feet across, and it's 10 feet tall from its top down to the other bedrock. It's part of the bedrock, but it is sticking up prominently, 10 feet, which is, you know, one story for us. So about one story, 50 foot across, certainly as big as this room. And for some reason, neither Solomon nor Zerubbabel chiseled that down when they leveled the surface up here. Certainly would have been easy enough for their quarry people. They could build a massive temple. They could certainly know how to chisel this down. It's a lot of elbow grease, but they'd do it. But it was left there. And the suggestion in one of the reprints that Brother Russell on his trip to Israel makes is that this was where the brazen altar sat. And it was given a prominent feature. And it was in a memorial in the sense, because when Solomon built there, he knew his father David had offered sacrifice just recently there under God's direction. And it seems that they would certainly know that Abraham offered Isaac somewhere on Mount Moriah under God's direction. And so this is where they wanted their animal sacrifices to be poured out. So we just ask ourselves, the curious thing is, why would the different developers of the temple not have chiseled that down except to leave it as this memorial site, as it were? Now, it doesn't add to our faith, but it doesn't take away. But we are curious about it because we find the place specifically recorded by God on these several occasions. He must think it's special for this purpose. Now, with that being said, what would the adversary do? Well, the adversary would like to detract from that memorial or monument. What better way than to have the Islamists come along? And they think that's where their prophet Muhammad took off on his horse up into heaven. And so that's what they portray there. Now, in a reprint, and let me see if no, it's different. Let me just say, in reprint 1395, I'm going to read this quote. "The original rock top of Mount Moriah is to be seen in the mosque, and a cave under it may be entered. A hole connects the top rock with the cave, and an aqueduct thence leads to the brook Kedron. Hence, it is supposed that upon this rock the sacrifices were killed and that the aqueduct or sewer connected by the hole in the cave was used for carrying off the blood and the water used in flushing and cleansing the altar. When we remember that the brook Kedron is in the valley of Jehoshaphat, the valley of dry bones, the general burying ground of the city, and then reflect that this valley was typical, as well as the blood of the sacrifice, we may read it thus. The blood of Christ, the antitypical sin offering, in a way unseen by the world in general, reaches unto all that are in their graves and secures for all mankind an awakening from death and an opportunity for life everlasting." End of quote. Isn't that awesome? The pastor gives us a little beautiful insight and then gives us the symbolical lesson. Now, I'm just going to pass this around for what it's worth. I was there, and this is a postcard. And they don't let you take pictures inside. You can get bigger books that someone must have paid a lot of money that they did get to take a picture, but you could buy the souvenir. Now, I went in, and I went into that little cave underneath, and I looked at that hole, just like Brother Russell talks about, and it's there, and you can't see much more than that. They have a wall around. This is very difficult to really see over the top of it. But this is an aerial view, and where you see this little gold light, that's the hole that goes into a cave underneath, that you can walk still into the cave, which is no bigger than the back room. But you'll see chiselings on the tarp. And like we say, it's 50 foot across and 10 foot off of bedrock. That That's what this showed us here. So, for what it's worth. For what it's worth, kind of interesting. Now you don't have to go. Another aspect, then, that we wanted to bring out was that in 1882, Colonel Gordon, now we're going to Colonel Gordon, in the Holy Land, he read in the Scriptures, John 19:41, that in the place where he was crucified, he was buried nearby, laid in a tomb. Talking about Jesus, of course. So Gordon started looking, where was this hill be? And he found what we call today, Golgotha. We pointed out as Golgotha. And nearby, very close by, we would almost say right around the corner, he found a garden and a tomb. Now, the long and short of that is that when the tomb was found, it was actually 6 feet below the surface. Just a little portion of it was showing, like the little window that you happen to see, we happen to see in the pictures. And they had to excavate down. Now, the owner of the garden was a Greek man. And 15 years earlier, he had discovered this tomb, and he had thought that maybe there would be something, artifacts he could find to sell. So he paid to have it dug out. But he let it backfill back in. Gordon, through various means, he ended up paying to have it excavated. And he determined that this fit the scriptural description of the place where Jesus might have been laid, called the Garden Tomb. So he went back to England, they formed a foundation, raised up some money, purchased the property, restored it, dug down the earth in front of the Garden Tomb to what it looks like today, and that's called the Garden Tomb Society, and we can go and visit there. Now, the interesting thing is the Roman Catholics have a totally different place for Golgotha. They have a totally different place for the tomb. And they built a big church over it, and it's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, totally different location. And they made it so unappetizing that I just peeked in the door and I couldn't even stand going in. It was so terrible. But you go to the Garden Tomb, and I thought it was very interesting that it wasn't until the late 1800s that this was really rediscovered. It was like preserved and saved from the Roman Catholic idolatries. And it's almost as if at least the Protestants could see that they weren't going to do all of that to it, and we didn't have to struggle with it. We can just say this is a good possibility. We certainly wouldn't die for it, but it's a good possibility. Now, on our handout, what we wanted to ask you to do is look to page 1 on the big handout, and bottom right-hand corner, quoting from reprint 3900, you can see my fine hand printing there. Reprint 3900, let's read that. The entire distance from Castle Antonio to the hilltop called Calvary is about 3/4 of a mile. Calvary is the Latin name signifying the skull. Golgotha, the word used by Matthew, also signifies a skull, being the Aramaic, the original language of the Jews in Palestine. The name was probably applied because, looked upon at a little distance, it much resembled a skull. A recent writer thus described it. 200 yards outside the Damascus Gate of Jerusalem is an isolated white limestone knoll in contour like the crown of the head and about 60 feet high. It contains in its perpendicular face the most remarkable likeness to a skull. The two eyeless sockets, the overhanging forehead, the lines of the nose, the mouth, and chin will be plainly seen. It is also concave and the same color as a skull. On the summit of Golgotha, there is a great pit heaped over with stones. This pit is filled with the skeletons and bones of criminals who, from time immemorial, have been crucified in stone. The bodies of criminals are still hurled into that same pit. A mighty earthquake upheaved this solid earth and split the very rock asunder. To the right of the skull and the face of the cliff is oddly riven, At the bottom of the western cliff is a large garden with a very ancient well. Where it touches the foot of the cliff, 6 feet below the surface, the rock-hewn sepulcher of our Lord has been discovered. This is now a general consensus of agreement that this is the true Calvary. End of quote. So here again, Brother Russell printed this and allowed us to have this insight, even though he is citing from someone else. Now, in the picture right above that quote, what you see is an old photograph where they showed you how they tunneled down in the earth right in front of the cliff face and found the entrance into the garden tomb. That shows you how much earth was in front of it. Today, it's not like that at all. It's just like the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall. It used to have dirt coming right up. When the Jews got hold of it in 67, they excavated all that out. Okay. Turn to page 2. On the right-hand side, the middle photograph, that's how we would see it today, and this is what we're used to seeing. All that earth in front of us cleared away. And we see the door and we see the window. But up above that picture, you see the face in the cliff. You see the two eye sockets and you see the mouth. Well, this is an old photograph too, because today you can't see that mouth portion because the Jewish people have actually built a bus station at the bottom because they don't care about this. They built a bus station there as a bus terminal and it's paved. And how fitting it is for the world not to recognize such things. It's of the Lord. He permits it. But anyway, you can still see the eye sockets. And if you were there today, you would walk to the left. That would be to the west. And you'd enter into what is that garden area. Now, they found the deepest, largest cistern in all of Israel in that garden. Why were they collecting water, possibly with water in the garden? They found an old olive press there, which means it was a working garden with olive trees producing. And so that fits well with the scriptures that we can look at that show it was a garden tomb. It was laid in the garden tomb. Now, on the same page too, while we're here, on the left-hand side, we have a map. And on the map, You can locate the Temple Mount, if you will. Then you see on the edge of the Temple Mount, up to the top a little bit, you see the Fortress Antonio. That's the fortress where Jesus would have been denounced and would have received his sentence. It's where he would have been abused by the Roman soldiers. That's where they headquartered. Then they would have walked him down you see the little street there called the Via della Rosa on the map. But instead of going down straight and then down to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre like the Roman Catholics have, you actually turn northward, going up the page, and you go out the Damascus Gate. You see the Damascus Gate on there? And then you just go up a little bit and you see the skull, rock, and you see the garden tomb next to it with the arrow. And the writer says that's about 3/4 of a mile. But it's uphill. And Jesus would have been carrying a cross, Brother Russell suggests, is about 200 pounds weight because it had to support the weight of Jesus, and he was probably around 175 pounds as a perfect man. So you have to have a cross that's heavier to support that kind of weight. So, nonetheless, in all of this, we do think that this comports much better than the Roman Catholic version of it. And Brother Russell seems to allow for that as well. Okay, the tomb itself was what? Hewn out of rock, right? We read that in the Gospel accounts. It was hewn out of rock. So that suggests it was a rich man's tomb. You and I both know from reading the scriptures that there were sepulchres, which were stone boxes with a stone lid. Remember, the whitewashed sepulchres inside are dead men's bones. Those line the Kidron Valley. That was a less expensive way to get buried. You see, when you live in a stoning land, you can't just blast out graves like we think of. So they built them out of stone on top of the land. A wealthy person could pay to have a chiseled a chiseled burial place, chiseled out of the stone. But you would have to be a wealthy man to do. Well, that's our Joseph of Arimathea. He was a wealthy man. He gave up his part of the tomb. But turn with me to John, the 19th chapter. John 19. And in verse 41, and it says, "Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new sepulchre, wherein was never man yet laid. There they laid Jesus thereof, because of the Jews, preparation, for the sepulchre was nigh at hand." So we have two explanations now. It was the day of preparation, so they wanted to bury him quickly. And this tomb was close by. Well, that fits this garden tomb location. It's right around the corner. We're told in Matthew's account, it was out of rock. Here, we're told that it's in a garden. So we start piecing that together. That all works. But it also says it was a tomb where never there was a man laid. Now, hold that thought, and let's turn to Luke's gospel on this. Luke, and it's going to be Luke. Oh, excuse me. Luke 24, no, I'm giving you the wrong, sorry, I'm giving you the wrong reference. It's a different gospel. It's going to be, 53. Excuse me?
2453, parallel account.
2353. That is that same account. I'm looking for a little different clue here. And, excuse me, here it is. It's Mark 16. This is what happens when you blend two talks together. Mark 16 and verse 5. Talking about the women. They entered into the sepulchre. They saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted. And he said unto them, "Be not afraid. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, which was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. Behold the place where they laid him." Now, why does it tell us the angel was sitting on the right side? The angel's sitting on the right side. First, he's sitting on something. He's on the right side, which implies that he pointed to the left side. See where they laid the Lord. It's not like he's sitting here. If there was only one place to sit, maybe that would be true, but not to say he's on the right side. Pointing to the left, then. When you look at page 2 at the bottom, you get a top view of that garden tomb. The top view, you go through the door, number 1. You enter in to like a little antechamber, number 6. The antechamber, the larger room, has a low wall between it and where you have two stone beds carved out of the stone. That is number 4. And number 8. That's where the bodies would be laid out on the stone beds. The antechamber, the larger room, was for prayer, for the family to come in and pray or pay their respects, view the bodies, if you will. This shows this was a tomb of a very wealthy individual to have this much work done. But you'll notice that there's a dotted line on number 8. It was never finished. That bed was never done. But number 6, that bed was done. And at the left-hand side of it, toward the antechamber, number 5 is a pillow that's cut in the rock, which shows that's where the head would go. But at the other end of it, the opposite end, you see an irregular bump out chiseled in the stone. It's not nice and squared off. It's just chiseled in rather roughly. So the thought is that Jesus was laid on that left side from the antechamber when the women would enter. The angel was sitting on the right side, that point number 8. He's sitting on the unfinished stone slab. It was a new tomb where never man was laid yet. So they probably had chiseled this out for Joseph, an older man, his wife, Jesus, as a perfect man, was probably taller than the older man, Joseph. In a hurry, they chiseled out a place for his feet to extend it to make it bigger for him. It was measured for Joseph, but Jesus happened to be taller, which doesn't surprise us as a perfect man. So they hurriedly would have chiseled this out. If it had not been in a hurry, they would have taken their time and just chiseled the whole stone slab further down. So it would have been nice and complete. And if you went through the trouble of chiseling a place for a stone pillow to lay the head, certainly you just would have extended the wall down further. But they didn't. And why did they not finish the other loculi? Because once the Lord had been buried there, Joseph wasn't going to use it to bury himself or anyone else out of deference, even though we know the body was taken away by the Lord later. But the point is, it would have been out of deference. So here's a possibility. Again, we wouldn't die over it. Someone has a different opinion, all well and good. But there's some reason why in the Scriptures it gives us this much information. The angel sat on the right, said to the women, "See where he lay." So somehow we have to integrate that in whatever proposition we propose. Okay, I'm going to leave it there at that. That's some of the background. There's a lot more you can read about when you look into this as far as the garden tomb and a lot of the past experiences there. But we've used the majority of our time on that. So let us now go to Matthew. And we want to turn to Matthew, the 27th chapter, I want to pick up about verse 55. But I want to ask you, this is the point. Why do you and I believe Jesus is resurrected? Why do we believe it? You know, first we say it's in the Scriptures. True. Very true. How did it get in the Scriptures? It was recorded by apostles and the others with them. Very true. But what did they record? They recorded an eyewitness account. And that's why we believe. We've got eyewitness accounts that this is what took place. And that's where we want to start in 27:55. Jesus had been crucified. He died on the cross. And in 55 we read, "And many women were there beholding afar off, which followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him. Among them was Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James and Joses, and the mother of Zebedee's children. When the even was come, there came a rich man of Arimathea named Joseph, who also himself was Jesus' disciple." Now, I'm just moving through this. I'm not doing it justice. But then we read that he begged Pilate for the body. Pilate gave it to him. 29, Joseph took the body and he had it wrapped in clean linen cloths. Verse 60, he then laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock, and then he had a great stone rolled over the door of the sepulcher, and he leaves. 61, and there was Mary Magdalene and the other Mary sitting over against the sepulcher. Let's stop. The women who knew Jesus, they came with him from Galilee. They knew this was Jesus the Messiah. They watched him hung on the cross. They watched him until he expired. They watched him take down the body. They watched him as they wrapped it in linen. They watched it as they laid it in the tomb. They watched as his great stone was rolled to the door. There was no time that they left Jesus' body out of their sight. There's no chance of an imposter, because these women weren't going to be following some stranger's body laid in that sepulcher. The Lord gave us eyewitness accounts through these women. And their devotion. And here's how we know that this was indeed Jesus of Nazareth laid in that tomb. Now, okay. They put a guard before the door. This is the religious leaders wanted this. And so they made their watch. And then in chapter 28, verse 1, we read that in the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, this is what we would call our Sunday, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. And his countenance was like lightning, and his raiment white as snow. And for the fear of him, the keepers did shake and become as dead men. Let's stop right here. Let's stop right here. The Brother Russell suggests that the women and the disciples had scattered to different locations around the city of Jerusalem that night. They were residing in different places. He suggests that the women had agreed when they left the garden after seeing Jesus' body laid away, that they would come back after the Sabbath with the proper spices, and they would really do him justice in his burial. And they would meet there. And so they would be coming from different locations. And he suggests that Mary Magdalene and Mary and Salome, these three women, stayed wherever Peter and John were. And he suggests this based on John's account that Mary Magdalene left the garden and ran back to tell Peter and John that Jesus' body had been taken away. So she knew where they were staying, so he suggests they had been staying together. Now what I'm going to present is the idea that there were two groups of women, two different groups of women, at two different times that came to the garden tomb that morning. There was the first group of Mary Magdalene, Mary, and Salome. They were the first, Salome, they were the first to arrive. And Mary leaves to tell Peter and John. These two women remain, eventually go into the tomb, get their witness from one angel, and then they leave. Afterwards, the second group of women arrive. They get their testimony, and then they leave to tell the disciples. Then we have our apostles, Peter and John, running up, having their experience. They leave, and then Mary Magdalene's there again, alone. Now, I'm giving you the overview. Let's try to put this together. Matthew's the only account that we read about the guards. It's the only account we have the angel sitting on the stone. It's the only account that it looks like lightning. And so it's very fascinating that Matthew tells you this, because it was Matthew that also told us that they set a guard in front of the door. So the women, when they were coming, they were walking up early in the morning. They're thinking, how are we going to get this big stone rolled away? The Lord knew that he was going to take care of that. So the Lord wanted the witnesses to be undisturbed, unmolested that morning. He wanted his witnesses to be able to tell us what took place, that the tomb itself was empty. He had risen. We need these eyewitnesses' account of the same ones that saw he was buried there. So he's got to get rid of these guards. He's got to get the stone removed. So it's like in today military lingo, what we hear on the radio, it was like a shock and awe experience. The Lord sent his angels to encamp about that garden tomb and do everything necessary for his witnesses to come and be unmolested. So an earthquake takes place that rolls the stone away. Why does the angel sit on the stone? So the guards don't roll it back. He's got to get rid of these guards. So he appears like lightning. They're like dead men. And then they come to their senses and flee. They can see they can't do anything with this. So, got rid of the guards, secured that garden tomb, got the stone rolled away. But the first group of women, they walk up. The stone rolls away. See, the guards are gone. The angel's not sitting on that stone anymore. The guard's gone. Mary Magdalene says, they stole the body. They stole him the body. She goes, I'm going to go tell Peter and John. She runs off. Well, Mary and Salome are still there. So, well, it's all quiet. Well, let's go see. So the two of them, probably with a little trepidation, they walk in and they go into the tomb. And here's this angel sitting on the right side. And he says, see where he lay. Go and bear witness. So the two women then leave. They had their testimony and they leave. In the meantime, Mary Magdalene is still on her trek. She's on her journey. But let's turn to the Luke account. And this is going to be Luke 24, starting in the first verse. Now, upon the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they came unto the sepulchre, bringing the spices which they had prepared and certain others with them. And they found the stone rolled away from the sepulchre. And they entered in and found not the body of the Lord Jesus. And it came to pass, as they were much perplexed thereabout, behold, two men stood by them in shining garments. And as they were afraid and bowed down their faces to the earth, they said unto them, why seek ye the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spake unto you when he was yet in Galilee, saying, the Son of Man must be delivered under the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again? And they remembered his words, and returned from the sepulchre, and told all these things unto the 11 and to all the rest. It was Mary Magdalene. Now this is the part that you have to do some homogenizing. Really, Mary was there before and later. Luke is just telling you the names of the women who did visit that morning. There was Mary Magdalene. There was Joanna. There was Mary, the mother of James, and other women that were with them, which told these things to the apostles. We don't actually think Mary Magdalene was in this second group. But Luke is telling us about all the different women that came. And he says other women. Now, Matthew only mentioned two. Mary Magdalene was one of them. He didn't mention Joanna. And when you read in Mark's account, it says Mary Magdalene, it says Mary, and it says Salome. Doesn't mention Joanna. So, and then when those... In Mark's account where we read, it was one angel sitting. Here we have two angels are in there. Now, you suggest, you know, this does a suggestion. Why one angel sitting on the stone? Well, we clarified that. Why one angel when only two women came, but now we've got two angels when we've got a bigger group of women? And I'll offer one simple suggestion. What we're going to see is the manner in which the linen clothes lay was to bear testimony for the apostles. And we'll see that in John. But what would have been the inclination of these women if they came? They would have folded up those linen cloths. They would have tidied up the sepulchre. It would have been their nature out of doing honor before the Lord. So he put two angels there so that they wouldn't have been so inclined. Not one angel sitting on the right side, but two angels standing, which would have prohibited that. And with more women there, they would have been more likely to have done it. It's just that beautiful nature of wanting to nurture and tend, but it wasn't to be at that time. So the second group of women have left. Now let's turn to John's record, where we get so much information. John was so insightful. And John's account is going to be in the 20th chapter. Actually, I'd like to back up into the 19th chapter for a moment, and let's take a look at verse 39. 19:39. And there came also Nicodemus, which at the first came to Jesus by night, and brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pound weight. Then took they the body of Jesus and wound it in linen cloth with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Now, just hold that thought. Okay. Just hold that thought. Now let's look at 20, verse 1. Then the first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early, when it was dark yet, unto the sepulchre, and seeth the stone taken away from the sepulchre. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken away the Lord out of the sepulchre, and we know not where they've laid him." Peter therefore went forth and that other disciple and came to the sepulchre. So they both ran together, and the one disciple outran the other, outran Peter, and came first to the sepulchre. And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen clothes lying, yet went not in. Then came Simon Peter following him, and went into the sepulchre, and seeth the linen clothes lie, and the napkin that was about the head, not lying with the linen cloths, but wrapped together in a place by itself. Then went in also the other disciple, which came first to the sepulchre, and he saw, and he believed. Then, verse 9, for as yet they knew not the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. Then the disciples went away again unto their own home. Okay, let's put this together. When the Jews buried, don't think of the mummification mummies of Egypt. It's not the way they did it. They took the spices and they wound it around the limbs, around the torso, round each leg independently. They want to get the spices as close around the body as possible, and they separately wrapped around the head. This was how they got the linens there. So, in John 11, you'll remember this, when Jesus raised Lazarus, what did he say? I'll just give you the reference here. You'll remember this. It's John 11:44. And he that was dead came forth bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. And Jesus said unto them, "Loose him and let him go." Lazarus didn't hop out. He shuffled out in the sense. He could walk, but he was bound in the sense. He had the spices wrapped around each leg with these linens, and he had a separate one around the head. Now, when you look at the Greek word on the wrapping of the head, what you find is it's turban-like. That's what it's really like. It's turban-like. I mean, it's not like a napkin. We just get kind of a misconstrued concept out of the English. But the Companion Bible and other resources demonstrate that it was a wrapping of a separate linen cloth, turban-like, around the head. Okay. When they looked at the way the linen clothes lie, on that stone pillow that we saw, the linen wound about the head was laying there with its spices on that pillow. But there's no neck there any longer to connect it to the wrappings around the part of the body, which were lying still in the form of a man laid out there. But because Jesus' body was not there, they collapsed in place. Now, let's think about it. Brother Russell in the second volume offers us two suggestions, doesn't he? He says Jehovah might have turned the body into gases, or he might have had the body supernaturally removed and preserved for the future someplace as a witness. And I don't struggle with either one. I like both. Let the body have been supernaturally removed, turned into gases is fine with me. Today we might say it was atomized, but it was supernaturally removed. It didn't have to have the stone rolled away. And let it be reconstructed at some future time, or even now, some place that the Lord has as a testimony to mankind in the future. All well and good. But the linen clothes were left there. Now, what was the big argument? that the Pharisees were making. They said that he would rise on the third day, set a guard so his disciples don't steal his body away. Well, here you go. The apostles came, these two disciples come, and the women, and they know someone didn't steal the body away as soon as they look at how those grave clothes lay. Because if someone stole the body, they would have taken the grave clothes with them. Or, if they didn't want to, they would have had to unwound it all with all the 100 pound of spices. Do you think they would have recreated it? It would have been a big mess, a big pile there. But if you supernaturally removed the body and those grave clothes, linen clothes, collapsed in place, they've got the witness they need that something supernatural took place. And as soon as they saw it, it says, verse 8, then went in also that other disciple when he first came in the sepulchre, and he saw and he believed. He saw and he believed. What did he see? He saw the body was gone, but the grave clothes were still laying there. So he knew no one had just stolen the body. Now, okay, that's our suggestion on that. What happens afterwards? Verse 11. Disciples are gone. One little point. You notice? It doesn't say the disciples took any linen cloth with them, did they? Early Christians weren't interested in relics yet. That would have been the time to collect the greatest relic of all. You could have had the burial cloths. They weren't thinking like that. That crept in later. Verse 11. But Mary stood without at the sepulchre weeping. And as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the sepulchre and see if two angels in white sitting. Now the two angels are sitting. The one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. And they say unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? And she said unto them, Because they have taken away my Lord, and I know not where they have laid him. And when she had thus said, she turned herself back and saw Jesus standing and knew not that it was Jesus. Jesus said unto her, Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou? She, supposing him to be the gardener, said unto him, Sir, if you have borne him away, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away. Jesus said unto her, Mary. She turned herself and said unto him, Rabboni, which is to say, Master. Jesus said unto her, Touch me not, cling to me not, for I am not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say unto them, I ascend unto my Father and to your Father and to my God and to your God. And then that's what Mary did. So Mary, in her emotional and fatigue, she's run two ways, she's all worked up, we certainly understand why, she looks in, sees the two angels, she's not even thinking about it. She talks to them like she doesn't even recognize their angels. The other women, when they saw the angels, they bowed down, they were afraid. She's just so upset, she just looks in the window. Interesting, she looks, stoops down and looks in. It's like looking in that window. But nonetheless, she's so upset, it doesn't even act like she's talking to angels. Doesn't even think about what convinced Peter and John there. She turns away. The Lord apparently makes some noise. And the Lord, we think, blesses her with her being the first one that he appeared to. Now, you'll find both thoughts in Brother Russell's writings. In the second volume, he suggests Mary Magdalene was not the first. But there's four reprints where he suggests she was the first, and I put them on your handout at the top on the one side, so you can consider those. I think for myself, reading the accounts, I like his thought in the reprints that she was the first, and here it is. She wasn't penalized for running off to do the responsible thing to tell Peter and John what had taken place. So what happens? We think immediately after this, Jesus dematerializes from her, and this is really our closing element here. We turn back to Matthew, and this is where we'll integrate in Matthew 28 that we read in verse 8 and 9, as they departed quickly from the sepulchre with fear and great joy and did run to bring his disciples word, and as they went to tell his disciples, behold, Jesus met them, saying, all hail. And they came and held him by the feet and worshipped him. Then said Jesus unto them, be not afraid, but go tell my brethren that they go unto Galilee, and there shall they see me, and so on. So, we're going to suggest that this was Matthew inserts it here, but it's actually after Mary Magdalene had her appearance with Jesus, and Jesus told her, cling not to me. But when he then appeared to these women who were still in the way, he allows them to bow down and worship before him. See, he had a time frame. He wanted briefly with Mary, gave her the first privilege, comforted her broken heart, gave her great joy, and now he met these group of women whom he also appreciated had come and gives them their testimony. But it's not in the garden. It's as they've already left. So, he didn't leave Mary crying in the garden. He rewarded the other women. He gave Peter and John the witness. We don't have any other scriptures that any other disciples went to the garden. Because once they had the testimony of these eyewitnesses, they were convinced. They were satisfied. And then when Jesus appeared, he also elaborated. And so the angels who had safeguarded the garden had overruled that all things worked out just that way on the morning. They leave that garden and let the garden just fall back to where the Lord's done with it. It served its purpose. We don't worship there. We don't need that as a place of worship. We can worship anywhere to serve the Lord in truth and spirit. But we appreciate if there are these historical, geographical places that the Lord has honored and will be used probably for mankind in the future, in particular in the kingdom, to help establish the record and convince them. And then when these witnesses are brought back and resuscitated, and then they give their accounts of all the various stories of what really took place and all, what a marvelous thing that will be for the people of earth to go and visit and see these places and have their testimony. Now, what better guides would you have? That would be a nice employment for these guards who left now humbled, if they fully accept and repent, to say, yeah, I was one of those, but how merciful the Lord is, and I hope I get to do this for the next 700 years, and I just love telling people about what really happened. But by the Lord's grace, all these things are wonderful food for thought. And if it's not this way, as the brethren have said, it certainly is better. Thank you.